Andrew Bunny Wang is one of the world's most esteemed hackers. He's the author of The Hardware Hacker, is a research affiliate at the MIT Media Lab, and helped create a device with Edward Snowden to stop your phone from being spied on. Here's our conversation. So I'm here talking to Andrew Bunny Wang. Thank you very much for talking to me today.
Yeah, sure. Happy to chat.
So just based off the conversation we've already had, I mean, you're interested in a lot of different areas in technology. The first instance where I believe I had heard of you was, and this might be a good way to sort of kick off our chat, was when you were a plaintiff in a lawsuit that challenged the DMCA, which was the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Could you first explain for people who don't know what that was and why did you challenge it?
So you're referring to the one involving the NETVCR that filed fairly recently, correct?
Well, the one I had thought of was when you were with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Is that correct? Back in
Okay. I just want to make sure you're talking about the same one because I've been in a couple of challenges against it. This sounds like the most recent one. Yes. Sorry. So you want me to explain the DMCA or the lawsuit itself?
Well, I suppose the DMCA would be wrapped up in the explanation of the lawsuit.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. So basically, there's the statute, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which essentially makes decryption of or sort of accessing of copyrighted materials that have been controlled, oftentimes through cryptography, a crime. The sort of simplest way to say it is that decrypting stuff that you already own becomes a criminal act underneath it, right? And this is a problem, for a number of reasons. And it greatly inconveniences a large group of people who need to access content for various lawful means, like archival or literary criticism, visual criticism, remixing, or even just viewing your stuff in different formats that the original presenter may not have had the foresight to imagine. And so the current lawsuit against the United States government centered around a device that I want to build that would enable people to be able to take video that has been sort of content controlled through an encryption and, give them the right to be able to access the unencrypted content for various lawful purposes, ranging from doing some machine learning on it to add subtitles, remixing it to time shifting it so you can watch it at a later time or watch it on a different device, format shifting, a bunch of stuff like that. That's basically it in a nutshell.
When you say the content is you want to modify that. Can you give an example of something that, I know you mentioned subtitles and so on, but what would this, generally speaking, apply to? Is it software? Is it, movies and TV?
Yeah. So, and specifically in this, what we're looking for in this lawsuit is it applies to video. Actually, there's a co-plaintiff who also has another thing they're asking for as well, but my portion of it is referring to video content, which is typically oftentimes delivered encrypted with a form of encryption called HDCP, which prevents you from doing anything with the video, say, in between your set-top box and your TV. So one specific example of something I would like to do is maybe you're viewing, I'm trying to learn Chinese. My Chinese is not good enough, and reading is very hard. And there's no way to, when you see a Chinese character, you don't know how to pronounce it. And typically, when you get, say, subtitled content on a DVD and you put on the Chinese subtitles, it's just those characters with no knowledge of how to pronounce them. So it seems like it'd be a really easy thing to do some very, very basic character recognition, do a lookup, and then add sort of the English sort of pronunciation guides on top of it. The pinion? Yeah, the pinion, right. You can do that in line between the, you know, your set-top box, your DVD player, and the TV. But because all the content's encrypted across that cable, you can't do anything with it. It's just white noise. And it's actually not lawful to go ahead and remove that encryption for the purpose of doing this kind of subtitling under the DMCA. So this is an example of something, you know, kind of a prohibited act that I think would be very reasonable that I would like to be able to do.
And what is this device that you've built that you want to challenge, make this lawsuit in the first place to in order to like have it be legal?
Right. So I built a device called the NETV2, which is a FPGA-based video processing device. It basically has the ability to manipulate video feeds, and the first generation of it kind of does a little hack where we never decrypt the video, so we don't know what's on the actual feed, but we can take another video feed and encrypt it to the same key as the video in a synchronized fashion, which allows you to swap out pixels one for another, so you can get overlays on top of video. So if I wanted to put a Twitter banner on top of a TV feed so I can watch sort of contemporaneous tweets with a TV program, I can do that with this device. But that device, because it doesn't decrypt anything, can't do anything intelligent with the video incoming feed. It can only overlay additional content. And so what I'm asking for, inside the lawsuit is I would like to actually be able to push a firmware update to this, because it's an FPGA-based system. I can actually change it into a device that does decrypt the video, and then enable, you know, sort of these applications I'm talking about. But I can't actually push that update until it becomes lawful. If I did it before that, then I could be liable for huge, you know, crimes.
And the hardware and firmware for the NETV, they're freely available under the Creative Commons license, right?
Yeah, various open source licenses. They're specific to the types of content, but yes, they're free to download.
And that's a topic that I wanted to get into, because when we talk about open hardware, I think a lot of people can intuitively appreciate the idea of open source software, where, you know, the code is public and anyone can contribute. But open source hardware is like, you know, like, how would that even work? First off, how did you get started modifying hardware? I mean, why is this important to you?
I mean, for me, ever since I was pretty young, hardware was always presented to me without the case on it. My first computer that we got was actually an Apple II clone that my dad got from Taiwan. And because it was a clone motherboard, it didn't have a case. It just stuck on a piece of plywood, and it just sat in front of me. And so it was very clear to me that there wasn't, this box that was doing things. It was this green motherboard that cables came out of. And so there's a one-to-one connection in my head that this piece of thing in front of me was a thing that I could touch and modify and play with. You know, this is back in the old days. You have to plug in expansion cards to get, like, you know, 80 character output or different things like this. And so there's this notion that, you know, hardware is changeable and it's modifiable. You could build your own boards for it. So that's kind of, you know, how I got started and how my sort of proclivities developed from a very young age. And so generally, when I see a piece of hardware, it doesn't occur to me that it's forbidden to open it up or to change it or to understand what's on the inside. It's a pretty natural thing for me. So that was the first part of the question. What was the second part of the question?
No, I think the basic question was, you know, how did you get into this, modifying hardware? It's funny that this has become your life. I'd heard, though, that you said in some interview that you had flipped a coin to decide whether to go into biology or electronics. Is that true?
That's true. That's basically true. I had and still have a huge interest in biology, and I actually do, you know, some work with a biotech firm and lab today, even to scratch that itch. But biology in itself is actually a form of hardware. If you think about it, humans are sort of the ultimate machine. If you think about it from a chemical machinery standpoint, it's a complicated system. And the aspects of hardware that appeal to me are kind of parallel in human biology. It's a complicated thing. You can sort of unravel it. There's things you can do to it. When I was in college, I had taken both the kind of early bio courses and the early electrical engineering courses. And I was like, which one should I go for? And then sort of essentially one day I was just walking out of class, like, well, I'm going to declare my major as electrical engineering. That's just what's going to be. So.
Interesting. I'm glad it turned out that way, but it's funny how those things sort of hinge on a coin flip. What are the advantages as an engineer for the hardware to be open?
Oh, as an engineer? So as a person who's on the sort of making and creation side, you mean?
Yes.
It's hugely advantageous. I mean, because as an engineer, you want to, let's put it this way. A classical sort of circuit board level hardware engineer is completely reliant upon the documentation and example circuits that are provided to them to integrate the whole system together, right? Almost every complicated design starts from a reference design that's given to you by the vendor of the chip. So in a way, that free flow of information is absolutely essential to getting anything done. You can't just expect someone to read a very dense and opaque data sheet and then derive the circuit from first principles. It doesn't make sense, right? So just going towards the open hardware side of things where the whole design plan of a circuit is, you know, and the integration is shared with you just sort of makes it easier for people to innovate. Like, you know, why do we have to reverse engineer the geometries of this phone case or something in order for us to build an accessory for it? Like, you know, it makes it just easier for people to plug and play and create things once they have the design source. And a lot of the, you know, when people don't share with you the source, it's not like exactly for the phone case thing. It's not like I can't take a pair of calipers and measure out everything and create a model of the phone that exactly matches the model, you know, the phone that you sold to me. It's just that now I can get it wrong and I have to do another iteration of it. Or, you know, it's just like, it's another layer of just annoyingness that doesn't actually help anything in my argument of things. And if someone's building accessories for your phone, it increases the market you can hit. So it's actually, I think, you know, beneficial to, you know, people who make goods to share the specifications of it, particularly, you know, on the interfaces and the APIs. But a lot of people are I think unduly afraid of people stealing ideas or competition or whatever reason they make, and they don't share these things.
Right. Well, that was the whole argument against open source software in the beginning, of companies being like, why would we give away our IP and, you know, the code itself? But it turned out that, you know, it's actually beneficial for a lot of companies if you have, you know, a team of people around the world, a network of people working on your code. When you talk to people on more on the business side of things, are they receptive to these ideas?
It depends. It depends upon the business, and there's a generation gap, definitely. I think in terms of understanding the importance of openness, it's actually sort of a weird bathtub curve generation gap. So it's like, you know, the very, very, very old hardware guys remember a day when everything was open, and they get it. And then there was sort of this decline into open, very closed hardware around the 80s and the 70s that happened. And then there's a group of people who sort of came of age in the sort of 70s to like 2000s, I would say, that those 30 years where closed source just became the mantra in hardware. And now, more recently, the past decade, a couple decades or so, you're starting to see sort of people getting, you know, they sort of see the exemplar of the success of open source software and seeing ways that it can apply to open source hardware, and people are sort of dipping their toes into that pool and feeling a little more okay with opening things up.
Well, it's interesting because you had a TED talk where you talk about these two separate systems for creating technology, and you compare and contrast the way we do it in the U.S. and the way it's done in China. And Could you talk a little bit about that contrast, these two different systems for developing technology?
Yeah, so that bathtub curve and that attitude I was referring to is more on the Western side of innovation and their perspective. So when you're talking about comparing and contrast the Western attitude towards what happens out in Asia, so in China in particular, and a lot of other, you know, sort of the affiliated ecosystem, you find, you know, there's this sort of platitude that they just steal stuff and everything's, you know, it's a wild west of intellectual property, which is like a very reductionist way to sort of like look at that ecosystem. And it turns out that, you know, basically as I was saying before, not sharing the specifications is not good for interoperability in sales. And in the sort of the Asian ecosystem, it's easy to have a factory. It's easy to build stuff. And anything that creates a barrier for you to go ahead and sell your items to someone else becomes, a stopping point for commerce. And so a lot of people are just like, look, we just need the schematics, we need the plans, we need the firmware copies, whatever it is. And then once we have those, we can build products based upon it, and then business happens, right? People will buy your stuff. And so you see a lot more just sharing of data sheets and firmware and code samples and PCB samples, because it helps the commerce out there fundamentally at the end of the day. And it's difficult to explain that shift, because from the kind of the classical sort of American based or Western based engineer is that you don't, as an engineer, you don't think that you have a direct connection to your factory. In fact, as an engineer, you create an idea and then you outsource it to a factory and you want to control that factory, right? It's like it's sort of out of your control. So you really feel a great ownership of that IP, because once the factory has the IP, they can just produce it over and over and over again without giving you a royalty or something like that, right? That's a frustration of sort of Western based engineers. But in Asia, because if you're an engineer, you usually also have a factory if you don't own it, you're very closely tied to them. They're good partners of yours, and you have a trusting relationship with them. There's not that distrust of the people who are making it. It's more about seeking the opportunity to sell more at the end of the day. So when all the engineers essentially have factories, the value isn't on the IP, the value is on the actual revenue that's generated by selling the items. And so you find people are very much more willing to share, designs, and particularly the APIs and the things required to integrate the designs to facilitate business.
Yeah, it's interesting, because the I think one of the points you made was that this system is overall better for society, as a whole, and which is, it feels hard to argue against, because if anybody can mix and match any part, then of course there's going to be more creativity as a whole. Do you see one of these two systems though as being fundamentally better than the other?
Well, that's a very subjective question as to what's better.
Right.
Depends on who's to benefit, right, at the end of the day. I'm biased, right? I like to believe that sharing things at the end of the day is better. You know, if you step back and you look at the tide that makes all ships rise, and you're looking to empower equally the small people as well as the big people on top, I think it's better from that perspective. If you're a large corporation and you're trying to increase profits for shareholders, then, you know, the more barriers you can put up against competition, the more you can raise your prices. So the system's not actually better for you or your shareholders in that case. And so it really, I think it depends upon which perspective you're coming from as to a metric of better, right?
Is there any truth, though, to the complaint of engineers in the West that, you know, oh, if somebody can just take my idea and produce it somewhere else and I don't get any money from it, you know, should those people Do you feel like they have a right to be obsessed or upset? Do you feel like people like necessarily own these ideas, or maybe that's more of a philosophical question? But
yeah, I mean, I think that so the worry is that you put this effort into to invent something, and you took some risk and investment to invent it, and therefore you should be able to make enough money from the risk and effort you put into it to justify the risk you took. I mean, I think that's a perfectly valid view, and people should be entitled to getting some protection at that level. I think that the main disconnect is that some people, so basically the easy out is that, I can essentially write a patent that covers a huge broad category of things because I've, managed to get a good lawyer and I've managed to button up all the things. And now, because I'm the first to file that thing, everyone later on who tries to reduce this practice owes me something. And part of the problem I feel with that is that a blocking patent on a very, top level type of thing sort of saps robs value from everyone underneath. So let's look at the self-balancing scooter, right? That was a big thing where people couldn't even figure out who made them for a while because there's so many companies in China that are making them, and there was also a clear inventor, person who had a name on a patent for that particular thing. And, while there are some elements of the self-balancing scooter that are interesting, right, perhaps even novel, in order to build that effectively, you need to be able to have these very, high torque, low RPM motors, you have battery control systems, you have batteries, and you have, casings and metal injection molding, all this sort of stuff to sort of build that complicated, compact system. And, what is the relative value, for example, of the IP in those very difficult to make motors versus the relative value of the IP in the general concept of a system employing those motors into a self-balancing scooter, right? So there's, I think the value should be allocated to both parties, right? But the problem with the sort of the patent on that category and assigning all the value to that inventor means that people, it really deprives those people who have to work hard to create those subcomponents any sort of royalty or value of that mechanism, because they, the person who has the top level patent accrues most of that value. So it's a difficult line, right? But in this case here, you see that sort of stark contrast of you have an inventor who doesn't have a factory, who has the patents, and then you have a bunch of factories who have created actually a lot of really valuable IP, I think, in terms of how to build the motors and how to build the batteries and the control systems and all these sorts of things that people then are putting together like Legos almost to create all this huge variety of self-balancing scooters. And that explains entirely why no one can point to a single factory as to who are making them, because there's all these primitives that people are just snapping together, at the back end in these factories to produce what is actually a pretty, easy to produce idea. Once you get the concept of it, there's not a lot of magic to it. Whereas if I said to someone, well, how do you build these, high torque motors that go in the hubs? Like, explain to me the tricks and the physical principles behind it. It's actually a lot harder from the physics standpoint than just the notion that you have an accelerometer and a control system that, the inverted pendulum is like a physics 101 experiment, right? How do you ascribe value to that ecosystem? And the thing is, at the end of the day, these guys who are in China who own the factories, who build all these subcomponents, they're in a position to monetize their ideas immediately. So some guy comes up with a better way to make a motor winding. Some guy comes with a better way to make a higher sort of density magnet, right, in terms of magnetic output per weight. And these guys, because they own the factories and they have the idea, they can embody their invention almost immediately and start making money for it, right? So they'll just put the specs out for the motor and here's the hub dimension, here's the drawing for it and whatever it is. And then people just sort of shop amongst available vendors, pick the best one, integrate into their product, and business starts, and these people are able to monetize their research, very quickly. So these people do take some risk in developing these items, but they also are able to very quickly reap a benefit from it because they're so closely connected to the factories. Whereas if you don't own a factory, you can take a big risk to sort of develop something, but it's also very hard for you to monetize it, right? So one fix to that problem is, well, we'll just make it very hard for people to copy ideas. Another fix to the solution is maybe make it very easy for people to engage with factories. And so sort of the China side solution is let's make factories easy. And the Western side solution is let's make copying really hard.
Why are factories so much easier in China?
There's a lot of reasons for that. It ranges from, sort of a cheaper but also pretty well-educated labor base, which is important. There's an ecosystem sort of a economy of scale effect. So, the parts and subcomponents you need to do a factory is much easier to acquire. So in America, if you want to do, for example, a motor factory, you need suppliers that can give you windings, that can give you stampings, that can give you magnets, that can give you, the carbon brushes or whatever it is you're going to put into it. And if you don't have those suppliers, you now have to buy those machines and to do it. In China, if you want to start a factory that's building a motor, you have a novel idea, you can actually almost find all those individual pieces from sub-suppliers, buy them, integrate them, see if the design works, and as you start to scale up, you only then start to buy the custom machinery to bring your costs down on your good idea, right? So from that ecosystem, it actually takes out a lot of risk of developing a new design and new product. So that's a very important part because, a lot of people say, why can't we just put the factory back in the United States? It's you don't just need to replicate that one factory. It's like that whole ecosystem that de-risks the venture. That's sort of a shared risk that all those people have that's important. And then there's other sort of factors that contribute, like, China does have pretty lax environmental and safety constraints, which if you were to try and start some of these factories in the U.S., it would just be almost impossible to comply to some of the regulations, the amount of, scrubbing and cleaning equipment you have to comply with regulations would be prohibitive. And that's probably a good thing at the end of the day, but it also makes it pretty hard to do something in a cost-effective manner.
Well, I mean, is there a way to merge these systems? Would a shorter lifespan for copyrights be useful?
Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely. That's one of the sort of, if I were to be asked to, what is the fix to this? It's something like a shorter term limit. Like 20 years on a patent is an eternity for technology. Like 20 years ago, if you think about what we had versus today, it's like, ridiculous. And the problem is that, we have sort of one size fits all patent law. Patent law also applies to pharmaceuticals, which take at least 20 years, right, to produce something. And it's a huge high risk, very capital intensive venture, and we want to protect those as well. And then we have, self-balancing scooters, which was like a 2-year blip hype thing, and then it's gone, right? So do you actually really want to codify the trends of technology into, U.S., sort of regulations? That's going to take forever because, anything, an act of Congress takes, as we all know, it's virtually impossible these days to get through. So this is like very difficult question of sort of how can we get the legislative system to be more agile? How do we structure the patent system in general to fit the particular trends? And basically all we've seen is that, unfortunately, because it's so hard to get an act of Congress through, it's the people with a lot of money who can force change, and the people with money tend to be the corporations, and so you see patents and copyright terms getting longer and longer and longer because it benefits the incumbents, people who manage to, kind of win at the IP game. Because they have very long terms to monetize it, it benefits them to sort of lock it up, almost in perpetuity. For copyrights, it's a lifetime. So it kind of blows my mind that sort of the assets, the things, the characters that I loved when I was a kid, I'm never going to be able to own my own culture in a way, right? I can't take those cartoon characters that I saw and as an adult remix them and turn them into an expressive form of my own. Those are my childhood is eternally owned by, you know, various corporations. And I have to, you know, it's like, I don't know. I mean, I guess we're okay with that now, but in a way that feels weird to me, right?
Oh, I think it's absolutely weird. And it seems like this is, in the lifespan of human history, relatively new. I mean, if we had had patents on like the compass or gunpowder, I mean, we would have entirely different, you know, story of human history. Do you think then that this is, I mean, on the surface, all these ideas make sense to get rid of, you know, much of the patent restrictions. Have you had any hope from, you know, like, let's say the past decade in terms of, you know, people talking about these issues or a willingness by, you know, behalf of politicians to open up to these ideas or no?
Well, yeah, there hasn't been a lack of trying to find hacks on the patent system, at least on my side. Yeah. Like, I've looked into sort of ways. It's even worse than just, like, the term being awful. It's like, because now we move to a first-to-file system, you don't even have to be the inventor of an idea. So there's currently, like, this really big risk for open source is that, you know, we put really good ideas out there, but we don't tend to patent them, right? And so what open source is actually just a huge trove of ideas for trolls to file patents on. And then later on, say we're the first to file that idea, therefore you owe us money on it, right? That's sort of the end.
That is so crazy.
Yeah, it's the asymptotic endpoint of all this. Be the first to file. If you didn't file it, then, you know, too bad for you, right? And people can file and then come after you. And so it's important to be able to sort of create prior art so that the patent office doesn't grant a patent on something that's already well known out there. But the problem is that sort of, it's weird because I think it's almost written, I think, into the code or it's some very bureaucratic process to sort of tell patent examiners the minimum number of things they have to look at before a patent is considered novel. And at the moment, it's basically they only have to search prior patents and a few other very, very public records that are very hard to get before they have to say that something is novel and hasn't been out there before, right? They don't have to look inside GitHub. They don't have to look inside really journals or academic. I mean, journals are a way to fight it, but they're not required by law to check that, right? So it's like this ridiculous thing where it's, you know, an idea can be extremely well known within a community of people who use the idea very actively. But the patent examiner's office, in particular, that particular examiner isn't aware of that idea, and a troll happens to know that examiner and knows him well, they can just basically ramroad a bunch of patents through and then kind of shake down people for thousands of dollars, however much they want, depending upon the value of the idea. And basically up until the cost barrier of doing like a review on the patent, like an IPR, which is around the hundreds of thousands of dollars. So now someone can basically take a whole, you know, subsection of ideas, as long as they can get the patent, go to those people and say, give me $10,000, or, you know, we're going to put an injunction against you, sue you. And then people then call a lawyer and say, well, how much does it cost me to fight this? They owe at least $100,000. And those people are like, oh, $10,000 is less than $100,000. We'll just give this guy $10,000. And that's how the system works. There's like no way. Like, I don't see a fix to that currently. Yeah.
Has that happened yet with open source, where people have patented something that was open source and then turned around and demanded money of the people who actually created it?
Yeah, it happened to me. Yeah.
Oh my God. What happened?
So actually, more specifically, it happened to a company that I've been involved in and my collaborator, GT. She has a patent. She has a website called patentpandas.org that you can go to, and it has some stories of her run-ins with patent law. And her and I had created a circuit sticker, which we then put into a crowdfunding campaign. And we were selling these things. And a person had purchased these in the crowdfunding campaign, and then about 8 months later filed a patent on the circuit sticker, which it was then granted. And then came after us, demanding us that we should, you know, buy this patent from her for $5 million or something ridiculous like that. But it was like this has happened.
Wow. That is... I had heard when, after you graduated from MIT, you went into industry and you said you hated it. Is that at all related to what we're talking about here, like the restrictions on collaboration, the patent regime, things like that?
No, the industry stuff, I mean, I think I was, at that time, I didn't even really understand I had rights as a human being.
Oh, God.
I mean, it was because, like, it's one of those things where, like, it wasn't until, like, I already hated industry before I quit it, and then after I quit it, I found I had to give everything I worked on back to the company, right? It's sort of like, it's this weird thing where you want to have a portfolio and you want to say you worked on something, but your agreement on the dotted line basically says, oh, you leave, give everything back, and now when people says, what'd you work on, you really can't show people the thing you did, so it really disadvantages you to quit. That was like a more of like, you know, the door hit me on the ass out the building, right? But in the industry itself, it was just more corporate politics and just dumb stuff like warming a seat for 8 hours a day, even when it's not necessary. It just frustrates me, just the lack of flexibility and you know, people who follow the rules for the sake of following rules. It didn't jive well with my sort of personal ethic, but it's whatever. I mean, like, some people, it's their jam. Like, they really like consistency. It helps, you know, schedule things, and you know, you've got to pick up kids and drop off kids, so an 8 to 5 makes sense. I didn't have those constraints, and I'd rather be able to sleep in when I'm tired.
Yeah. Well, I think the vast majority of people don't like that. I think they like having some kind of freedom and flexibility, and based on my own limited experience, seems like engineering kind of offers that more than other areas of the corporate world to people. But you, yeah, you say that half.
Well, I've met people who really appreciate the consistency as well. I don't want to pass judgment like there's really good reason to want an 8 to 5 job. That's completely fine. It's a really a preference thing, I think, at the end of the day. I don't want to be like, oh, like my ways.
No. Of course. Yeah, absolutely. But you have done, a lot of, since then, a lot of, really just like fascinating things in your career. You designed a device with Edward Snowden that helped you, notified you if your phone was sending radio signals. I think it was called like radio or signal snitcher or something like that. How did that happen?
Yeah, so that was called the introspection engine, and the idea behind it was, so originally I got introduced to Ed by I think it was a Vice reporter who was working with him at the time about sort of anti-surveillance on phones, and they're working on like moving microphones and stuff. And he mentioned that, you know, we could do so much more if we got hooked up with some, you know, people who can build hardware, and like one of the guys that I would love to talk to, like Bunny Huang. And that Vice reporter happened to also have contacted me before, and so she intermediated, and we had a conversation, and we're like, yeah, sure. I was like, this would be a really cool thing to work on. And kind of at the end of the day, what we the kind of the user issue that you're facing is that sort of encryption is hard, security is hard, but, you know, people who are trying to do journalism or activism or whatever it is, they don't have time for crazy verification routines, and like, oh, it's just a bad user experience at the end of the day. So what you want is, you know, just give someone the phone that has all the utilities that they need to do. And wouldn't it be great if that phone wouldn't betray your position, you know, at the end of the day? Whatever happened, you could like know something was wrong with the phone, right? And so we built this thing that sort of tacks on to the sort of the command and control bus for the radios inside of an iPhone. And so whenever the iPhone main CPU wanted to do anything that involved the radio, it'd have to ping that bus and configure the radio chips. And then we would know, in effect, that it's talking to the outside world, and we could flag the user. By the way, your radio's on. Maybe you should look into this, right? That was the concept behind it. And it would be otherwise just a stock iPhone. So put your apps on it, you know, use your camera, do your journalism. It'll be great. It turns out that it's, technology is never so simple. It's a lot more complicated than that. Like one of the problems is that even when we put the iPhone in airplane mode, it still wakes up its radios pretty frequently, and we did a little more research into it, and it turns out that it's totally within Apple's terms of service, and they even say it on their website that, yeah, your phone's going to ping GPS every now and then. That's just a thing we do. They don't tell you why. We assume it's because, you know, they're trying to build their mapping database, and they want to just sort of do a GPS scan, see, like, you know, what Wi-Fi device is around, report it so they can sort of build the mapping database. So it's kind of like a non-nefarious thing, right? But it's very hard to differentiate activity like that from activity that could betray your position to an enemy. And so without more visibility into, like, the core OS and sort of all the complex policies that are in place, it's very hard to build a device that just passively notifies you if your phone is behaving as it should be behave, because, you know, what is proper behavior in a day and age where, like, you know, user agreements essentially include surveillance clauses?
Right. Right. That kind of brings us to another issue. Do you have a strong opinion then on the whole Huawei situation? Obviously the U.S. intelligence community says that there might be a likelihood of Chinese spying on Huawei phones, but a lot of people in the tech community says that that's just, like, not a concern right now. I mean, do you fall on either side of that debate?
I do have an opinion. I just have to know what I can say and not say publicly. There's a couple of things I know about. But basically, I think I can say. So basically, let's do a thought experiment, right? If it were the case that someone did actually find a backdoor in a Huawei device and it was discovered, it probably would have been a bigger deal in the public, right? Like basically no one can, you know, a lot of people say that there is a chance that there are backdoors, but no one's been able to produce a smoking gun, you know, insofar as like a real nefarious, like there's like dumb stuff, like people left SSH keys in a home directory. That could, maybe it's nefarious, maybe it's not. It's like, come on, like as an engineer, it's very, you know, it's pretty conceivable that you left a maintenance key inside a device during the debug phase, right? That's like not, that's not, it doesn't reek to me of extremely deliberate, right? And the sort of stuff that they seem to be worrying about are these very kind of deliberate style backdoors. And I just feel like the more believable explanation is that, as it is, the United States, a lot of the phone infrastructure in the United States, around the world, is built by U.S. companies. And it's kind of known from the Snowden leaks that, like, the U.S. has the ability to do surveillance through all these devices. Like, they have control over this network. And so the thought experiment is, if that Huawei then controlled that network, what would happen to the U.S. surveillance capability? So it's not so much that they're worried that Huawei, I mean, basically what they're saying is that we know that we put backdoors inside all of the Western equipment. We just assume China will do that. And so we'll accuse them of that, and then also sort of drawing attention away from the fact that we do it. But then, you know, the real kind of justification is that if Huawei now owns all the 5G equipment and the United States has none, then the U.S. loses its surveillance network, right, at the end of the day. And that, to me, seems a little more consistent with the facts that you can see of the lack of the smoking gun and sort of like the gestalt of the world and the timing of things. I find that to be that one holds up a little better for me, but it's hard to, it's really, you know, these are all circumstantial opinions based upon rumors and stuff like that float around. So it's very hard to sort of, you know, write a solid journalistic piece sort of pointing at something and claiming you're right about it.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely see it being an excuse, either to stifle Chinese competition in the markets or to protect, you know, surveillance hegemony. But it, right. Is there any case though? Because as you said, the U.S. definitely collaborates with their own tech companies to get access to data and stuff like that. Why wouldn't China do that? I guess.
I mean, sure. I guess China could do that too. They may do it. It's just the thing is we haven't found evidence of it. It doesn't mean
yeah.
I think that. I mean, one of the other sort of contrasts. I find generally between sort of the way China does its surveillance, the way U.S. does it, is that the U.S. government tends to be very discreet. They don't want people to know they're watching you. And they tend to, backdoors is sort of like the de rigueur. China tends to be a bit in your face about the surveillance. They don't really care about your consent for surveillance. They never really, you just walk into China and there's just cameras everywhere and you have to, it's just, and everyone just knows it. It's like, yep, China just takes the data, right? And they don't hide it, right? So sort of, in a way, part of the reason maybe they haven't felt the need to really collaborate and put back doors in these things is that they go through the front door, right? It's like,
oh, I see.
There's other places they can get access to the data between the users. They don't have to instrument like the cell phone networks because they have the whole Great Firewall and the edges are unknown to them, right? So why would you put a back door? And that's sort of so much effort compared to going through the front door. And now maybe actually because U.S. has sort of put this idea in their head, now the Chinese might be like, huh, this is a good idea. Maybe we should put backdoors and everything. And maybe they're doing that more actively. But I think, if you're already going through the front door in surveillance, why would you need backdoors, right?
Speaking of China and the U.S., you had said recently that open source might be a casualty of the ongoing trade wars. How so?
So this is sort of the idea is that open source is a thing that where you're sharing ideas kind of without any constraints on who you can share it with. And the trade war itself is about limiting access to IP and in some cases this is now export controlled. You can't send this across borders, right? And so, the Linux kernel, the Linux Foundation itself, Huawei is one of the, big members of it. And so, the RISC-V consortium has a lot of interest from Chinese companies at the end of the day. And so if the U.S. wants to go ahead and sort of play traffic cop on who gets access to open source, then what happens to the core idea of open source and the sharing of technology and who can get what, right, at the end of the day. And so I think there's an incipient risk towards open source if, once people start playing traffic cop on who can participate and who can get access to it.
Well, hopefully that does not happen. Hopefully they listen to people like you. But on that note, Andrew, thank you very much for your time. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thanks.
All right, thank you to Andrew Wang, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.